Case number 21-5243 et al. George Scilazzi, appellant versus Robert S. Mueller III, special counsel for the investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 presidential election and United States Department of Justice. Mr. Madden for the appellant, Mr. Janda for the appellees.
Morning, counsel.
Morning, Your Honor.
Mr. Madden, please proceed when you're ready.
With respect to Article III standing, the court initially held that Mr. Scilazzi had plausibly pled that the implications of footnote 112 caused him business and reputational harm. But then it turned around and said the Senate report, which was issued 15 months later, constituted an independent injury, and therefore, for prospective relief, the harm from the footnote was no longer traceable. And for damages, he couldn't recover damages after the release of the Senate report. The Senate report did not harm Mr. Scilazzi. There's no defamation in the Senate report. In fact, Mr. Scilazzi uses the Senate report to show how the implications of footnote 112 were so defamatory. Also, this was not an argument the DOJ made for the district court. This is something the court on its own came up with. There wasn't any briefing on the issue, it was surprising. For the Senate report to constitute defamation by implication, it would have had to stated that he was a Russian businessman, which it did not, that he had personal knowledge, implied that he had personal knowledge about these tapes, which he did not, and that he took active steps to suppress those tapes in Russia before the election, which he did not. The Senate report does no such thing. It first of all includes the full text, which footnote 112 did not do, and when you the context of the full text takes the implications of defamation away. For example, footnote leaves out Mr. Scilazzi saying, not sure of the content, a person in Moscow bragging about tapes, I'm sure it's no big deal. That's in the Senate report. That is not in footnote 112. The Senate report shows the context that all Mr. Scilazzi had was a phone call from a friend to him in Connecticut, saying that his friend was at dinner and overheard somebody talking about tapes. That's the only knowledge he had, and that he took no action. He had no personal knowledge, said report says, he took no action. And with respect to the Crocus Group, which gets mentioned in the footnote, the Senate report shows that that was something that was made after the Steele dossier came out, which wasn't out at the time of, this, of the text or the election. And so he just said, well, I told him there was maybe something there. And that's all. It's in the Senate report. So it's not defamatory. The independent harm argument is illogical. It's like saying the New York Times defamed my client, but the Washington Post 15 months later defamed my client, and therefore you have to dismiss the case against the New York Times. That's just not plausible.
Can I ask you?
Yes, sir.
No, please go ahead. Can I ask you about your desire for access to the transcript?
Yes, sir.
I think that Judge Cooper reviewed the transcript when he denied reconsideration. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
So if that's the case, why is your desire for the transcript, why is that claim not moot?
Claim is moot because this case is like any other case the D.C. Circuit has addressed. This is a case where the Department of Justice itself put into the public forum in a highly media feeding frenzy, part of the transcript. And when it did that, it misquoted the transcript and it left out material parts. And so DOJ's arguments about policy, they have been waived.
Why do you want the transcript?
Transcript, like the Senate report, gives the full context of what Mr. Scilazzi knew. If you can't get that from footnote 112, in fact, it defames my implication, but the transcript as a whole does not. And that's why we think it's only fair to release the transcript to Mr. Scilazzi. The Mueller investigation is over. This footnote destroyed my client's livelihood. All he wants is to be able to go to the public forum and say, look, this is what I actually said. That's all on that issue.
The whole point of getting the transcript is to disclose it.
Yes, sir. Senate report is also irrelevant to a statutory cause of action, which we have here under the Privacy Act. In Spokio, the court.
Okay, so say we agree with you that your client had standing on these equitable relief claims. Can you address whether you've even stated a claim for equitable relief under the APA or under the Privacy Act? There seem to be some hurdles there in terms of whether there was a final action under the APA and whether this was, a group of records under the Privacy Act.
Yes. Under 552A(g)(1)(a), if a person makes a request for amendment and is denied, the person is entitled to sue in court if it's in a system of records. And DOJ argues that it's not in a system of records. But that is, system of records in the Privacy Act is not set, it's not meant to be set in stone. Okay, so all it has to be is something that the agency uses to acquire information about a person by some identifier. And this is not 1974 when the Privacy Act was enacted. And so it just stretches credulity for DOJ to argue that this is not in a system of records, because I'm sure.
If I may, isn't the definition, it's a group of any records under the control of any agency from which information is retrieved by the name of the individual or by some identifying number, symbol, or other identifying particular assigned to the individual.
Correct, Your Honor.
What's the Mueller report?
Example, if there were a FOIA request for this information, DOJ would not go through page by page. I'm certain they have a model program that goes through, picks out the name, picks out any information you want on an individual. They don't go through this page by page. This is not 1974. Technology has come a long way. And particularly this court has said, when it's a formal investigation, the interests of privacy are at their highest. In any case, if the court doesn't agree with us on that, he's entitled to relief under the APA. Now, violation of 552G1C says the agency must keep records that are accurate and complete so that there's no adverse determination.
But there has to be a final agency action.
Yes, Your Honor. And DOJ argues that the final agency action is the Mueller report, but that's not what we're arguing. We're arguing that the decision by the Attorney General, who would announce that any information about a non-target that would be harmful would be redacted. It wasn't. And that's the final agency decision. He used his discretion under CFR 28600 to do that. So now it's true that in an APA case under that section, there's no de novo review, as there is for 552A failure to amend. It's abuse of discretion standard. But there's nothing in 552AG that says there's no equitable jurisdiction over a violation of C. It says if there's a violation of C, the district court shall have a jurisdiction.
Can I go back to the grand jury materials, the access to the transcript, just for a second? So if I'm understanding your argument, you only want the transcript so that you can disclose it, so that your client can disclose it to correct the record in the eyes of the public.
Yes, sir.
So does that mean that there's no independent interest in actually having the transcript itself, as opposed to being able to go in and look at the transcript, unless you can disclose? I mean, in some other cases, for example, somebody may want the actual transcript so that they can refresh their memory and they want to make sure that they have it right. And then the question comes up, well, you can go in and take notes. What's the difference between taking notes on it and actually getting the physical transcript itself? So I understand your argument. You don't care about actually having your hands on the transcript unless it can be disclosed.
That's right, Your Honor. We have looked at the transcript. We have taken notes. We filed a declaration on that.
Okay.
But our argument is when the government itself discloses part of the transcript and defames the non-target, the target is entitled to have the transcript to protect themselves. And
I mean, in other words, one way to think about this is we have our In Re Grand Jury case in which we talked about access to the transcript so that the witness can go in and look at the transcript. And then we specifically carved out whether the opportunity to go in and look at the transcript also means that you actually get a physical copy of the transcript. That didn't, we weren't even talking about disclosure of anything,
right,
the notes or the transcript itself. But here, you're not worried about that distinction because it doesn't do you any good to get the transcript itself unless you can actually disclose it.
That's right. Yes, sir. I may touch on the damages claim under the Privacy
Act. Can I ask, though, is that preserved? Because it was not my understanding that you had asked the district court for access to the transcript so you could disclose it.
Yes, we did. Specifically asked for that the transcript be produced without restriction.
Can you point us to where you did that? And I know it might be hard to name it off the top of your head, but maybe in your rebuttal.
If I could try to find it, if I can't, I'll send it to 28J immediately. We did request the transcript itself and unrestricted. It was denied by the judge.
I think the question is, you requested the transcript so that you could disclose it.
Yes, we requested an unrestricted copy of
the transcript. That's what you said. You made that argument.
Yes, sir. We certainly did. If I may just touch on the damages claim, the court went on and said, either it's Article 3 jurisdiction for this damages claim under the Privacy Act, that my client hadn't plausibly pled that the defamation was willful or intentional. When it did that, it applied a different standard than it did for standing. For standing, it looked at the footnote as a whole, said, yes, I agree. The implications of this footnote are defamatory. On the damages issue, it said, no, look at the Senate reports, just sort of just a little bit, almost the same. That's not what we're arguing. Once you show, and the court agreed, that there is defamation by implication, in that kind of a case, intent is presumed. So dismissing the case on the pleadings as a matter of law was improper. Even true statements can be defamatory by implication, and intent is irrelevant to those cases. And of course, you don't even need to prove actual intent in a Privacy Act case. It's just a little more than gross negligence or reckless disregard. So the court applied two standards for looking at the intentional willful part of the Privacy Act, which is clearly wrong based on our theory of the case. And of course, the record shows there is a clear conflict of interest with the chief prosecutor in this case. She did not tell Mr. Mueller about her connection to Hillary Clinton. And she certainly had control of the pen, and she had motive and opportunity to do what footnote 112 did for political reasons. And my client was caught in the crossfire.
Thank you, counsel. We'll hear from the, unless my colleagues have other questions, we'll hear from the government now. Mr. Janda.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Sean Janda for the federal government. I'm happy to address whatever questions the court might have, but in the absence of more specific direction, I think it might be most natural to start with standing. And to do that, I think it's helpful to sort of take a step back and really focus in on the statements that the plaintiff here claims are defamatory or inaccurate, and the ones that he isn't challenging, even in the Mueller report itself. And so, you know, the plaintiff, I think, has not disputed that he was in communication with Michael Cohen in 2015 and 2016 before the election, that there was communication about building a potential Trump Tower project in Moscow, that Michael Cohen contacted plaintiff because plaintiff had experience with business ventures in Moscow, that he discussed with Michael Cohen the possibility of a meeting between Mr. Trump and the highest level of the Russian government, that he suggested to Michael Cohen that they send a letter to the mayor of Moscow and sort of intimated that the mayor of Moscow knew about the project and would support it. And he doesn't dispute that he, in fact, was texting with Michael Cohen in October 2016 about the rumors of these tapes. And so I think against that extremely large amount of conceitedly true and non-defamatory information in the Mueller report, it's just really hard to believe that these specific alleged inaccuracies or the asserted sort of defamatory implications of the footnote have caused the plaintiff any concrete reputational injury. And I don't think that there's anything in the complaint or in the declaration that was filed in district court that really does the work of homing in on the sort of specific distinction between the alleged defamatory statements and all the other statements and demonstrating which has caused
any. Are you focusing on the idea? It seems to me you could be making two arguments here. Maybe you're making both, but one of them is, look, don't worry about the stuff that the plaintiff is focused on, because there's other stuff that corrects any misimpression. So this is kind of trivial, because anybody who reads the entire Mueller report will see that on page one, it says X, on page 994, it says Y. And if you put the two of them together, you'll see that the correct information is actually in there. That's one way to look at it. The other way to look at it is to say that the thing that you're focused on actually isn't all that big a deal, period, because it's, you know, it's just little subtle distinctions, like the addition of the word some and adding and having Russian or not Russian in there itself is not a big deal, regardless of corrective information that's elsewhere. Are you focusing on the fact that there's the correct information somewhere else? Or are you focusing on the fact that actually this isn't all that big of a deal?
So I think there's a little bit of the first one, particularly with the U.S.-based executive of a Georgian company description versus the Russian businessman description. And I think that the first one is accurate and is in the Mueller report. But more fundamentally, it's the second. And I think there's just a lot of information in the report. And so, you know, as I understand the plaintiff's sort of theory, it's kind of a time-based theory that after the report came out, he lost various business opportunities or other opportunities. And because there's so much true information in the report, I think that sort of time-based theory doesn't get him home. I think he has to sort of demonstrate that it's the stuff that he's actually challenging in the report.
Yeah, I mean, that seems like tailor-made stuff to win on causation on the merits. He's just not suffered any damages. And actually, if you look at it, it's really hard to believe that you could construct a theory by which that he can make out a claim for relief, because there's so many other intervening causes and there's so many other things that factor into it. At standing, it seems like asking a lot to say there's some stuff that the district court thought was actually problematic, in theory, at least at the motion to dismiss stage, because it's plausible. And then to say, yeah, but then there's other stuff, you know, elsewhere in this report, and then other stuff elsewhere out in the world, that actually, if somebody was omniscient and read everything in the world, they would realize that this isn't that much of a big deal. It seems like asking a lot at the standing stage on a motion to dismiss.
I don't think so, Your Honor. I mean, I would point the court to Ezell Trucking, which is one of this court's cases that we cite in our briefs, which makes clear that to really make out a concrete injury at the standing stage, in this sort of reputational injury context, you do need to at least have kind of the plausible facts that would give rise to those allegations, or to the conclusion that you are harmed by the thing that you're challenging. And, you know, it might be that there are facts that the plaintiff could have alleged, that he hasn't. But you know, I think just like any other plaintiff, it is the plaintiff's burden to come in and allege the relevant facts to get home, even on the standing piece. I mean, they might also be very good causation arguments if you get past standing. But it's certainly, I don't think you can skip over the standing analysis on the basis that it's just sort of hard for the plaintiff to do the work that the plaintiff has to do to make outstanding. And then, you know, I mean, I think the other piece of it is that even if you assume that there was some injury, in fact, some number of years ago when the Mueller report was released, as the district court found, it's sort of hard to understand how that would be redressable by a judgment today, when you have the intervening Senate report, which contains a lot of discussion about the plaintiff. And I think I searched the relevant volume and his name appears in it more than 100 times. There are sort of very extended discussions of contacts with Russia, of contacts with Michael Cohen, of the text message exchange that's referenced in footnote 112. And I'm not entirely sure what the plaintiff's sort of specific theory of addressability is, but it's hard to understand how a judgment, particularly when he could sort of distribute the Senate report to business contacts if he thinks that they're refusing to do business with him because of misimpressions created by the Mueller report that would be corrected by the Senate report.
But might there be people who might be aware of the report and haven't read the Senate report?
You know, that might be possible. I have no idea.
Yeah, I mean, boy, that's...
So that's standing, isn't it?
I don't think so. I mean, people who... The relevant class of people, I think, would be people who have read or are aware of the Mueller report, know anything about the Senate report.
It's highly speculative, I think. I think anybody who might have read the Mueller report and wasn't aware of the Senate report, if you concede that he had standing just based on the Mueller report before the Senate report came out, there'd still be standing. It's any injury.
So I don't think so, Your Honor. Well, two things. I mean, one is there's the injury piece, which we are contesting, but then the responsibility piece is it's not just people who read the Mueller report but haven't read the Senate report. It's people in that category that would then be aware of the judgment and would sort of revise their impression or conduct in some way on the basis of this court's judgment. And I don't think the plaintiff has demonstrated that there is sort of some group of people out there that would be aware of the report and the judgment, but not the Senate report.
So that would be true. Let's just assume that there's a blasphemously defamatory document out there. And everybody agrees that it's totally false and it's totally defamatory. And then a couple of years later, a second document comes along that has a different rendition that corrects the record. There's no action, as you only have standing to dispute the first one?
I think this doesn't come up that often, Your Honor. I mean, usually defamation is litigated in state court for damages where the redressability question just isn't really live. But I think we're not asking the court to adopt any sort of bright line rule or broad principle. I mean, I think the legal rule is given by, for example, this court's decision in Renal Physicians, which is that to show redressability, it's the plaintiff's burden to sort of plausibly allege the facts that could lead to the plausible conclusion that the third parties will sort of change the way that they are interacting with the plaintiff or will stop injuring the plaintiff on the basis of the judgment. And I think just in this very fact-specific context, the plaintiff hasn't done the work to make that demonstration.
Can I ask you about the second action before Chief Judge Howe, unless you had more, did you have more questions on the first?
Well, I just had one question. If we disagree with you on the standing issue, do we have to remand to the district court, or can we just hold that there's a failure to state a claim on those issues?
I think the court certainly can hold that there's a failure to state a claim. The district court actually dismissed the Privacy Act damages action on the merits, and this court certainly could affirm that. And then
equitable.
For the equitable stuff, I think we didn't ask the court to amend the judgment in any way. I think we're fine with the dismissal without prejudice, and it would be fine for this court to affirm the dismissal without prejudice on the alternative ground. The alternative merits grounds that we've presented and that I think are fully briefed before this court.
I know we can, but I guess the question is, should we?
I don't think those are pure questions of law. The question about certainly the final agency action question and the question about the system of records. I don't know that sort of any further development in the district court would be helpful or useful in any way. And so certainly if this court thinks that we're right on those threshold issues, we presented them to the district court. The district court didn't feel the need to reach them because it agreed with us on standing. But I think they're sort of fully aired for this court's decision.
But I hadn't thought completely about the without prejudice with the prejudice, actually. So if the dismissal is without prejudice, if the merits are reached, is it not a dismissal with prejudice?
So if the district court had reached the merits, it would have dismissed with prejudice. But my understanding is that it is appropriate for the court of appeals to affirm the dismissal without prejudice, even on merits grounds. We're not asking to amend or correct the judgment in any way. Certainly sometimes you would have a dismissal without prejudice, even on a merits ground, if you were giving leave to amend or something of that nature. So I don't think there's any sort of problematic thing about this court affirming on the grounds that we present.
So let's say we do exactly that. We affirm the district court, affirm Judge Cooper's judgment. Does that make Chief Judge Howell's case moot?
So I'm not sure that it would make it moot, Your Honor. I think it would change the analysis. To the extent that the plaintiff is getting in to Rule 6E under the exception for sort of disclosure in connection with another pending proceeding or another civil proceeding, it certainly would change the analysis. If there's no pending proceeding, I would think you would be able to get under that. Right,
well, I can.
But why wouldn't it be moot then? I mean, I get one argument would be that if the let's suppose that the transcript actually helps bolster some of the merits claims, including on the Privacy Act, because it can show the requisite degree of intentionality or something like that. Then in that situation, getting the transcript actually would make a difference.
So I think I understood Judge Walker's question to be if the dismissal of the civil action is affirmed, so there is no more civil action where the transcript could help on the merits at that point, there's still the pending request. You can make an unmeritorious request or a request that doesn't comply with 6E, and so I'm not sure that would be moot. I think were that all to happen and were this court not to just affirm Chief Judge Howell's decision.
I don't understand why it's not moot actually either way, regardless of what we do in Action 1. I think his motion in Action 2 before Chief Judge Howell about accessing the grand jury transcript, his motion was titled, he wants an order denying unrestricted access to the grand jury transcript, or alternatively, an order for the Department of Justice be directed to file the transcript under seal in the related case. And he got the alternative relief. So what's left?
So I think we have understood the request to be, primarily a request for unrestricted access so we can get a copy of the transcript, so we can disclose a copy of the transcript.
Sounds like he said, I'll take either.
And I think, a lot of the arguments he's now making in this court, now the transcript has been filed, about sort of correcting the public record and sort of correcting whatever misimpression he thinks was left by the report, weren't really aired in the district court. But we have understood Judge Howell's, Chief Judge Howell's opinion as at least denying in some part the relief that he was requesting. If this court thinks it's moot, I'm not going to fight you too hard on that, but
you sort of are.
It's certainly not how we have been thinking about the issue. And I think on the merits, again, it is quite easy for this court to affirm on the merits. There was really no articulated justification in front of Chief Judge Howell to support the need for unrestricted access, particularly in light of the sort of ability to have taken notes and to have disclosed the notes and the impressions of the transcript in connection with the civil action.
Can I ask, would it not be moot until the period for rehearing or for seeking cert expired?
Certainly it will be challenging at that point to put additional information into the record, if that's kind of the hook for the liveness of the claim. But I think to me, that's a merits issue. It's a sort of question about whether one of the Rule 6E prerequisites to disclosure is satisfied. It then sort of opens the door for the district court to permit disclosure. I don't think it's a jurisdictional issue. If someone came into court and said, I just really want a copy of my transcript. There's no pending civil proceeding, but I want a copy. I don't think we would say that's sort of a moot case. It was just going to fail on the merits because Rule 6E provides sort of the full set of circumstances in which the district court may authorize
disclosure. What if the plaintiff voluntarily dismisses the underlying action?
I think as long as the plaintiff sort of keeps the request in front of the district court, then I'm just not sure it's a mootness problem. If this court disagrees, we are perfectly happy, I think, for this court to say that it's moot at this point. It's not how we've been thinking about it.
But even if they dismissed it, then you think they could still take an appeal of the request for access to the transcript that is to be used in the action that they dismissed?
I think they could take the appeal. If the court thought that the original denial was on its own terms an abuse of discretion, then maybe the court would send it back, and the district court then, in reevaluating the request, would take account of the changed circumstances and say, well, now that there's no civil action pending, you have no need for the transcript, or Rule 6E is not satisfied. But I don't necessarily think that would moot the appeal.
Can I ask one question about the merits of the Rule 6E question? So if we're in a situation in which there's an entitlement to look at the transcript and to take notes and to basically transcribe the transcript by taking notes, then can I just hear your articulation of what the additional interest is in not disclosing the transcript itself?
So I think there's a couple things there, Your Honor. And so I think sort of number one, and maybe the most important one, is the one that was sort of articulated by Justice Brennan in dissent in the John Doe case, and then was sort of picked up by this court and grand jury, which is that actually coming out with an official copy of the transcript and having the automatic right to that copy of the transcript does provide an opportunity for any individual that might have control over a witness to sort of force the witness to come out with a copy of the transcript, check the witness's testimony to see what the witness said in a way that might well chill sort of free and candid testimony on the front end.
So that person could still force the disclosure of the notes if they have access to the transcript to look at, take the notes. And I take it in that situation, at least the person can protect themselves because they don't have to turn over the actual notes. They can make up some other notes. I mean, there's at least some
delta there. And I'm not sure even that in my grand jury stands for the proposition that you have to be able to disclose the notes. Here the district court imposed sort of restrictions on.
But if it's a pressure situation, then the whole thing is about disclosure, because if it's a third party who says, hey, go in and figure out what they're doing and let me know, then we're just assuming a circumstance in which that might come to pass.
Right. But I think the district court could well say, you have no automatic right of access to the transcript. You can take your notes, but I'm going to tell you, you can't disclose them to anyone. And then that wouldn't sort of cut off the, potential pressure, even setting aside the ability to fund things, mm-hmm. notes or whatever that might exist there.
And does that argument, if we rely on Justice Brennan's notion Is that just a something that's going to work in every case? So there's just a presumptive disentitlement to the transcript, and the government doesn't, even for a witness, doesn't have to come forward with specific justification as to why there shouldn't be disclosure of the transcript itself to the witness?
I think probably, but that's just what Rule 60 is. I mean, there's a strong bias in favor of grand jury secrecy, and a grand jury sort of, in re grand jury carves out that specific circumstance where the witness gets access. But I think as a general rule, any
because of the witness.
Right.
So we're in a land in which it's flipped a little bit because the person's actually the witness and they could go out on the courthouse steps and announce everything that just happened.
Right. So I think this court has carved out sort of an exception to the usual rules. But I'm not sure that means that sort of the exception should expand to swallow the usual rules. And the usual rules here are very strongly biased in favor of secrecy. And, you know, I mean, I think as we explained in our briefs, there is a pretty significant delta between the witness being able to just sort of say, here are the kinds of things I talked about, and the witness being able to obtain a copy and to show sort of, here are the exact questions that were asked, here is exactly what I said. There may well be sort of other individuals who could understand from the transcript things that the witness themselves might not understand. There's always sort of the veneer of not being entirely sure how truthful or accurate the recollection of the witness is. And all of those just go away when you have a copy of the transcript to sort of wave around in public.
Okay. Make sure my colleagues don't have additional questions for you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Janda. Mr. Madden, we'll give you 2 minutes for a rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. With respect to the assertions, hard to believe there were damages, that's premature, first of all. And secondly, Mr. Scalise has filed a declaration showing how he was damaged in that case. With respect to this, I can't believe this really harmed him. All you have to do is look at Rachel Maddow's transcript from a couple days after the footnote was made public and said, so that means Trump knew that somewhere in the former Soviet Union, a business buddy of his had taken action to make sure tapes, supposedly from Trump's trip to Russia, those tapes weren't getting out. Don't worry, all taken care of. I took care of that for you, right? There's the damage. That was a feeding frenzy worldwide on that issue. And failures to state a claim, just to reiterate, we believe there's standing under for equitable relief under the Privacy Act, damages under the Privacy Act, and under the APA. You're on the question of whether we asked directly for the transcript to be made public. I know we did. I cannot find it. I will submit it.
I just want to be clear about what my question for you is, though. I'll assume that you asked for the transcript with the authority to make it. I'll assume you asked for an access, unrestricted access to the transcript. But I'm wondering if you made the argument, we need unrestricted access to the transcript so that we can disclose it to the public.
Yes, Your Honor. I'm certain we did. I will find that for you. I will submit 28-J either this afternoon or tomorrow morning. Shit. On the policy issue of disclosure, as the court has said, the testimony belongs to the witness. That's the first rule. In this idea of policy, well, if you get the transcript out, there's going to control the witness. That is not applicable in this case. Mueller investigation is long gone. So we ask that this case be reversed, remanded, and sent back to district court with instructions from this court. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel. We'll take this case under submission.